He was her shelter in the storm of desperation that defined Adam. She wondered if the Greys had lost their souls. Was that their problem? They'd once been more fully alive than they were now, and they were searching the universe for some way to regain themselves? Adam rejected every effort she made to find out about his people, his world, any of it. If she tried to penetrate his mind the way he did hers, by latching onto the pictures stored there, all she'd ever get was white light, static. He blocked her. It was a little sinister feeling, truth to tell. What did he have to hide? She became aware of a siren outside, which was certainly unusual for University Park. This was not a siren-oriented neighborhood, no way. The deep booming horn that accompanied it announced that it was a fire truck. Well, that was more believable. There were dorm fires over on the two campuses every so often, usually involving mattresses or common room couches. Once in a blue moon, one of the beautiful old U Park houses burned. Still, it would be extremely serious if the facility was threatened in any way. So she got up from the couch, went to the front hall, and put on her jacket. "Hello," Ted said as she passed through the living room. "I'm going out, back in a few." He knew not to ask, of course. When she reached the street, she smelled a faint tang of smoke. Okay, that was to be expected if there was a fire in the area. She got in her car and drove to the facility. She was appalled as she turned the corner to see three big fire trucks in the street. Her mouth went dry as she began mentally reviewing the steps that had to be taken to protect the secure areas. Nobody, no fireman, no fire inspector, must go down that elevator. As she pulled into the driveway, she saw that the house itself was not burning, but there were firemen in the drive. She fumbled frantically through her purse looking for her credentials. Mike was in Washington and Andy was off. They often left Adam alone. He was safe down there, and when he wasn't being interacted with, he lay as inert as an abandoned toy. If he began to move around, sensors would alert her and Andy, and they could watch him from their laptops. It had never happened, though. She stepped out of the car and walked over to the firemen. Just the other side of their garden wall, there was smoke. "What's going on?" she asked. "Grass fire. Probably started by kids." "It's not going to come over this far, is it?" "No, ma'am. That's why we're here."
"Okay, thank you. Listen, I'm going to be in the house. If there's any change, please let me know."
She entered by the front door. Before going down, she went first into her office and turned on her computer. After it had voice identified her, she pulled up the feed from Adam's chamber. Unlike the human eye, the camera simply saw what was in front of it. On camera, you could sometimes glimpse Adam. He could feel you watching, though, and would usually disappear in under a second. She was shocked to find him pacing, the slim gray form speeding in a blur from wall to wall. At least he wasn't flying around like some kind of gigantic berserk blowfly. Immediately she went to the elevator, pressed her thumb against the print reader, and stepped inside. She dropped down into the pit. Quickly she prepped, just covering her face and hands with emollient and leaving it at that. Her skin was as stiff as leather anyway. She didn't bother with an antihistamine shot, but she did stuff an epinephrine injector into the pocket of her slacks. Then she stepped into the lock, waited for the outer door to close, and entered the cage. "Hi," she said aloud. She went to her chair, sat down, closed her eyes, and directed her attention to the physical sensation of her body. By thus removing her attention from her thoughts, she signaled to Adam that he could enter her. He rushed in with all the eagerness of a dog leaping to its master's breast after a long absence, or a lion pouncing. It felt like both things when Adam came into her. This time, he didn't go to her sexual memories, but rather to earliest childhood. She found herself back home in Philly, in Mom's study, and all the furniture was incredibly tall. She was gliding from chair to chair and her heart was soaring. It was a place he'd gone to frequently, the moment she had taken her first steps. She loved these memories Adam would bring up out of childhood's amnesia. Because of him, she had remembered her birth and even before a sort of secret communion with her mother in the womb. Then he went to a moment in the living room when she was about two, when she had stood watching the sunlight slanting in through the window, and listened to the voice of the sun singing a song whose words were deeper in her than even Adam could reach.
The message of these excursions into her earliest life was clear. See what I am about to show you with the open eyes of a child. She emptied her mind even more and waited. Drifting in like a dream, she saw Earth from above. North America was wheeling slowly toward the sunset, but the coastlines were changed. Florida was just a narrow spike, half its usual size. The Caribbean was mostly featureless blue. The whole East Coast was submerged beneath a brown scar of filthy water. Then she saw numbers, and she realized that these were a series of dates ranging from 2012 to 2077. She sucked in breath. She now understood the cruise ship, the starving supermarket. Adam was warning her about a great catastrophe. "Oh, Adam," she said, "I'll tell the colonel. I'll be sure to tell him." He began shooting around like a rocket, slamming into the walls with hideous crunching thuds. "Adam!" She leaped up out of the chair, but he was whizzing now, racing so fast she could hear the bzzz of his passing, but not see so much as a glimpse of gray skin or the gleam of one of his huge black eyes. At that moment, without the slightest warning, thick smoke came pouring through every air-conditioning vent in the room. For an instant she was frozen, her mind unable to take in what she was seeing. The smoke roiled along the ceiling, and she saw that it was filled with glowing red streaks. The lights began flickering, grew dim. "Adam," she screamed, "we've got to get out." In two strides, she was across the room. She fumbled open the cover on the bailout switch and hit it with the heel of her hand. Sirens erupted. The facility went to emergency lighting, and the door to the lock slid open. "Adam," she screamed, "Adam." The smoke came down like a curtain, turning everything inky dark. An instant later, the fire struck her head and neck with ferocious, terrifying heat. Covering her head, she dropped to the floor. "Adam, come toward me. Adam, stay low." Nothing happened. There was bare visibility here, and it was hot and getting hotter. She could smell in the stink of the smoke the additional stench of her own singed hair. The next breath she took caused a reflex of a kind she didn't know existed. The choking was a fearsome weight slammed down on her back, the gagging like some sort of spring unraveling in her throat. She backed out through the airlock and into the control room. Here, meteors of plastic were dripping down from the ceiling. She was sick with dread. She knew that she had lost Adam, but she also knew that she had to get out of this place fast or she would be burned to death. The elevator doors were open, but she would not dare to enter it. Feeling her way along, she came to the door of the emergency stair. She reached up into the heat and opened it. As she went through, smoke gushed in behind her, and she only just managed to get the door closed. Crying and screaming, she opened it a crack, but there was nothing but smoke, and now also flames licking into the shaft. "Adam! Adam! Adam!" The door began to crackle, and heat hit her in the face, even though she was low, and she had no choice but to slam it again. Crying and coughing, she began the long trek upward on the narrow circular escape stair. As she trudged along, pacing herself to avoid exhaustion, she racked her brain to understand how a grass fire next door had spread to the facility. Sparks must have somehow entered the ground-level air intake and started a conflagration in the air-conditioning system. Three-quarters of the way to the top, she dragged her cell phone out of her pocket, but it was still out of range. She continued on, reaching the surface so winded that she had to stop and catch her breath before she could even manage to open the door that led into the foyer. She felt it, noted that it wasn't hot. She cracked it, looked out into the foyer. There were two firemen standing there. Above her head, thuds indicated that another man was on the stairs to the offices. There was a rumbling from below, and smoke came bursting up the stairwell. In an instant, it was fiercely hot. Her eyes were burning, and she was choking again, even worse than before. She had no choice but to act. She could not stay here. Again, she opened the door. The intensity of the smoke increased at once. Behind her, the heat rose. Opening the door turned the stairwell into a flue. The next instant, the door flew out of her hand and the fireman dragged her out, slamming it shut as soon as she was safe. "Are you conscious?"
"Yes."
"Okay, dizzy?"
"No, sir, my chest is burning."
"Is there anybody else down there?"
She wanted to say yes. She wanted them to try to rescue Adam. That could not be allowed, though. These men had no clearances. These men could not enter the facility.
She fumbled in her jeans, drew out her credentials. "That facility is classified," she gasped. There's nobody else in it, and it cannot be entered without authorization.
This is a fire situation, lady. We're going to go in there.
No, it's illegal. She struggled to her feet, went for her cell phone again. I'm calling my supervisor. She punched in the colonel's speed dial and got his message. Colonel, there's a fire here. We're dealing with a lot of unauthorized personnel, and I need somebody here to control this situation.
She hung up. At that moment, Andy appeared. He came hurrying in and threw his arms around her. Then he held her at arm's length.
My God, you're burned. You have no eyebrows.
The foyer door burst open and fire gushed out with the ferocity of water from a burst main. They got out of there and the firemen began deploying hose.
It's totally out of control, she said to Andy.
Where is he?
I couldn't manage to save him.
Dear God!
They mustn't find remains.
We can't let them find remains.
I know it.
Her cell rang.
It's him, she said.
Colonel, there's a fire in progress here. Silence, then very calmly.
What happened?
There was a grass fire next door. When I heard sirens, I came over here from my place. The fire didn't appear to be serious, but I felt that I should be with Adam, so I went down. A few minutes later, the whole facility filled with smoke and fire. I've never seen anything like it.
What's Adam's status?
He's still down there.
Is he dead, then?
I would assume so.
More silence. Then a sound that Lauren thought might be a cry, but it was so loud and so close to the phone that it broke up into a series of shattering electronic noises. Then she could hear him taking breaths. He said finally,
"Okay, you cannot let those people down there. Anything could be going on. This is outside the envelope."
"Sir, I can't stop them. They're ignoring my credentials."
"I'm gonna blow somebody's brains out if this doesn't get handled,"
he said, but so mildly that it didn't seem like the threat she knew that it was.
"Sir, where are you? Can you get here soon?"
"I'm an hour out in my plane, damn it. You handle it, Colonel."
He sneered the word. Then he disconnected.
"He is one pissed off guy," she muttered.
"Oh yeah, he would be. You know what we lost here. We lost the most important thing this country possesses. That's what we lost, and that man is the person who has to take the heat for it. So he is gonna be pissed."
Mike couldn't pace in the plane. The cabin was too confined, so he sat rubbing the arms of his seat. He had to report this. He had to do it immediately. He said into the intercom,
"I need the code box."
This small, highly sophisticated device transmitted and received in quantum-encoded bursts that could not be decrypted by intruders. The first officer brought it back from the equipment bay behind his station, then returned to the flight deck. Mike turned off the intercom, then glanced at the flight deck door to make certain that it was closed. He pulled out the red handset and punched in Charles Gunn's secure number. It rang once, part of a second time.
"Gunn."
"Charles, I'm in condition 2101, do you understand?"
"God damn you."
"I'm in the plane, for God's sake. It was glass. Glass let a situation get away from her."
Glass doesn't matter anymore. Glass is a liability, and so are any other support personnel."
"I realize that, Charles."
"Well, act accordingly."
Mike replaced the phone. He stared, thinking. The Greys were not sitting still. They understood that there was a threat, and the direction it was coming from. Okay, first things first. Do the support personnel. Andy was a good man, and that would be hard. But Lauren, pretty as she was, he was going to enjoy putting her down. The goddamn bitch had lost Adam.
14. Dan had come home reeking of booze, of all the incredible things, and gone into the living room and begun playing the Ode to Joy from Beethoven's Ninth over and over again at blasting volume. He lay there now in front of the stereo in the dark, splayed out on the floor like a great gangling rag doll. She'd wanted to put her arms around him and mother him a little. His mother had been mostly indifferent to her little boy, and she felt that he needed the reassuring support of his woman right now. She knew, of course, what had happened. Marcy Cotton had ditched his tenure. She was scared, too, she had to admit, because they could not remain here on just her salary. So what was going to happen to them was that they were going to fall off the academic cliff into the stew of little tiny colleges and junior colleges, and spend the rest of their lives scrimping and scraping.
She looked at the clock, 8:20. She went into the living room, turned on a lamp.
Please. Dan, you've been in here for hours. Please let me be.
Dan, no.
He did not respond. She went on.
It's about time for Connor to get home, and I want you to come down out of the tree and face this together.
She had to bellow over the music.
Let's turn that off now.
She went to the stereo, flipped the switch.
Enough is enough.
He rose off the floor, then went to the bar.
What's in here? God.
He came up with an ancient bottle of creme de menthe, left over from some distant summer party when they'd poured it over ice cream. Earlier, she'd removed the rest of the booze to the garage.
You already stink of bourbon. I hope you didn't do this at the Peep.
The Peep Inn was the campus dive, where a professor most certainly did not need to get drunk.
I did indeed.
I consumed alcohol there in the absurd hope that I could drink myself unconscious before the fall of night.
Dan, we'll get by. Something good will happen.
Staring at her as if she was insane, he slowly shook his head. Then he bared his teeth and rocked back in silent, agonized laughter.
I got promised tenure by Marcy Cotton.
She thrust her hands at him, connected with his chest.
Go on. You did not.
He nodded.
And you won't be getting drunk again, so it's forgiven. Now Marcy told you she actually told you this?
He nodded.
You're going to get a yes on tenure. Oh my God.
He stared at her, his eyes hollow, his lips hanging slightly open. An expression that said that this wasn't the whole story.
If I needed punishment, how would you go about it?
What an extremely strange question.
Excuse me?
If I'd done something wrong.
What have you done? You've gotten tenure. That's hardly a matter for punishment. Is she sure?
Oh, yes.
He closed his eyes, shook his head. She realized then that he was trying to say that he had done something with Marcy Cotton, or... No, it couldn't be possible. You didn't go to bed for tenure, not even in this sinkhole.
Dan, are you telling me...
What?
I'm not getting it.
You're getting it.
Damn you!
The front door opened and Connor called.
I'm home, people.
And Dan said,
I'm so damn sorry, baby. I'm so damn sorry.
Connor breezed in.
Hi, Mom. Hi, Dad. I have just been at an amazing editing session. The Keltons have an awesome video and they're bringing it over and Paulie and his parents are coming and there's a chance that...
He stopped, looked from one of them to the other.
Hello?
Caitlin drew breath, drew it hard, trying mightily to contain the rage, the hurt that shuddered through her.
Mom?
She went to him. I want you to go downstairs for just a little while.
They got video of the UFO. Everybody's coming over to watch it on the big screen TV.
She did not exactly want a convention just now, but obviously she couldn't prevent it. You go down and we'll make popcorn when they come.
You sound strange.
She took him to the stairs and closed the door behind him. Then she went back to Dan, who was now slumped on the couch with his face in his hands.
You asshole, she said quietly.
Hit me.
Dan, I'm not physical.
But what I would very much like is for you to go upstairs and gather your belongings and take them with you and get the hell out of my house.
She curtsied.
If you would be so kind.
I don't know what happened. I don't know how to explain it.
You screwed her for your tenure.
I did no such thing.
And I find that grotesque, and equally grotesque that you confessed it. What happened to you? You're not this drunk, blubbering jerk I see here. I sure as hell didn't marry him.
Look, I want to ask forgiveness.
It's that easy. You get drunk and you cry, and what happens? I kick you around and yell a little, and this violation of your sacred trust is forgotten?
And if you go creeping off to sleep with her in the forenoon from now on, then what do I do? Just bear everyone in this miserable fishbowl knowing my...
What's the word? Shame, I suppose? My shame?
It left me... vulnerable. Somehow it affected me.
What did?
That incident.
Something weird happens and therefore you go make love to Marcy Cotton?
He shook his head, waved his hand at her. It made me want her. I don't know why, but it did. I relate the two things. What in hell are you saying?
I don't know.
Dan, I'm an orphan to the violence in my family, and you to the neglect in yours, and Dan, nobody but another orphan can heal either of us. This is why we're together. But you, you've taken something from us. And it is profound, Dan, because trust has a different meaning for people who suffered from betrayed childhoods. It wasn't over the tenure, it was... He shook his head. Oh, my love. It was like some demon flew in and sweated us with his fire. I think being so tired, so surprised and relieved, I just suddenly found myself in her arms. Don't tell me about it. For God's sake, Danny, have some mercy. He slumped yet deeper into the couch. He looked so tired, so sunken, nothing at all like the rippling, robust husband she adored, had adored. He looked like somebody who'd fallen victim to a vampire, shadowy about the eyes, gray of skin. Her stomach had grown tight and sour with fear. Her own skin was so cold she shuddered. This had been her rock, this marriage, in its honesty and the richly sensual capsule of its love. But how could she let him touch her now? How could she bear it?
Mama, what exactly is wrong? Connor, because something is and I need to know.
Connor, please.
He came into the room.
You two are fighting and I want to know why.
Figures appeared on the deck, looming up out of the dark, flashlights bobbing. Connor went to the door.
This is a chance for me. Don't wreck this.
Dan got up, started to kiss Caitlin on the cheek, wisely thought better of it, and greeted the Keltons.
You need to see this, folks, Affable John said. It really is genuinely odd.
It's not what it seems, Dan said. It's explainable, trust me.
Dad, it's not... Connor said. That's the whole point.
Dan went into the kitchen and picked up the phone. Chris answered on the third ring.
Have I woken you up at 9:15, old man?
We were out with the scope. It's a good night for the Crab Nebula.
Speaking of nebulas, the Kelton clan has arrived with what's probably a very nebulous video of that prank.
Prank?
The affair of the fiery balloon.
That could be historic footage.
How so?
You saw somebody in the field, buddy, and then you didn't. I think that somebody was an alien.
He had indeed seen somebody. It was also further support for the prank theory, but they could get to that later.
When you come, you might think about bringing some spirits. Montfermeil has stripped our bar.
He hung up the phone, then returned to the living room where the crowd had surrounded the gigantic TV.
We gather round the campfire, he said, and see shapes in the sparks. And thus the mythologizing begins.
He sat down. The Jeffers will be here directly.
Paulie Warner burst in from the kitchen, followed by his parents, and then Chris and Nancy. The energy in the room exploded as the two boys excitedly traded speculations.
It's the Greys, Connor yelled. They're doing an operation right here at Bell.
Okay, Connor, sure, Paulie said.
Terry said, what we actually have is some unexplained video.
Edited, Dan added. Most carefully, I'm sure.
Not really, John Kelton said, his voice sharp with annoyance. It's actually just pulled out of the camera, not edited at all. There's no reason to edit it.
We copied it onto a DVD, Terry said as he dropped the gleaming disc into the player's open tray. Beyond that, you're seeing what the camera saw. The player absorbed the disc. This was followed by blackness, then a couple of flashes.
Fascinating, Dan said.
Just wait, John snapped.
There was a sound of gasping, then crunching.
That's us running, Connor said.
You were really there?
Connor was there, Dan told Paulie.
Another flash, then a blur. Dan was beginning to think that this might be pretty minimal when suddenly the screen filled with light, and with screaming, as terrible, as powerful as it had been the moment it happened. Silence fell.
Paulie sat close to Connor, Dan was pleased to notice. He heard his own voice shouting, then saw himself and Connor in the light of the thing.
Connor, you were right there, Paulie whispered.
It was the eeriest thing Dan had ever seen. Two faint seams were present, one running the length of the object, the other around its center. Behind the thing, something seemed to be moving in the light, almost as if it was climbing out of an opening that was concealed by the object's bulk.
"There's your culprit," Dan said. "Nancy, be prepared to ID a student who needs disciplining."
The object rose a bit and seemed to shimmer. The woman's voice, which had been screaming and then silent, now cried out more clearly, and a cold horror shot through Dan as powerfully and unexpectedly as a lightning bolt from a silent sky.
"My God," he said, whispered.
"What? What, Dan?"
Connor was pulling at him.
"Don't miss this," Jimbo said.
In the flash of a single frame, the object disappeared, leaving behind it the fleeting shot of a figure barely visible in the dark. The figure seemed to turn, but it all happened so quickly that you could see little. There was silence, blackness. Dan heard his own voice say that he didn't think they were alone.
"It's the Greys," Connor shouted, jumping to his feet. "I told you, Paulie, it's the Greys."
"Yeah, you're right," Paulie said. "I gotta go to the John."
He headed out of the room. Dan hardly heard them. His mind was reeling, because Marcy had been involved. He had recognized her voice in that last scream, but what could it mean? Had she pulled the prank? Maybe she'd gone insane. It would fit with the bizarre seduction, maybe even vindicate him in Caitlin's eyes, eventually. There was going to be one hell of a siege. But then he thought, what if it wasn't a prank? What if Chris and Connor were right, and some sort of genuine anomaly was unfolding? Perhaps he and Marcy had both been traumatized by it. Psychological trauma was well known to drive people to sexual activity. It even had a popular name, Battlefield Syndrome. He was confused and frankly afraid. He wished he hadn't drunk all that booze at the Peep. He felt lousy, his head was pounding, and now he had this bizarre, impossible thing to consider.
"Boys, can you slow-mo the last little part?" Chris asked. "The figure?"
Terry stabbed a couple of times at the remote, and the figure appeared again, frozen, its back to the camera.
"Let me juice the contrast," Terry muttered. The scene became lighter, the figure more clear.
"Is that a balloon?" Caitlin asked.
"It's the head, Mom."
As Terry shuttled the image forward frame by frame, the figure turned in short jerks until its face was visible in a blurred three-quarters view. Total silence fell as every person there reacted to the image. It was not clear, far from it, but anybody could tell that this was no disguise and no inflated toy. The one fully visible eye was black and slanted, gleaming. It gave the creature a breathtaking look of menace. The lower part of the face was complex with wrinkles, like a very, very old human face might be, the face of a man deeply etched by the trials of his time. There was the tiniest suggestion of a mouth, little more than a line. With another flick of the shuttle control, another frame appeared. Now the mouth had opened slightly, and the sense of surprise it communicated was so vivid that it was eerie. Another flick of the shuttle, and the figure was gone. Dan found himself feeling his ear and remembering what Connor had said. Dear heaven, what if this was real? His mind rebelled. It just could not be true, because if it was, then he was involved, and so was Marcy. But why, in the name of God, why?
"Look at that," Paulie said as he returned.
He went to the glass doors and stepped out on the deck. Connor followed him.
"It's them," he said softly, his voice trembling.
"Jesus, it might be," Jimbo said.
A glow rose behind the stand of pines that separated the house from the field beyond. Dan went onto the deck. The glow was smaller, but it was still very damn bright and was indeed out in the field. Were they in contact? Aliens had chosen to land in a little college town? It just did not seem possible. No matter what was happening, that was not the whole story. Then he saw stars slowly wheeling around him, an aura, another one, the third in 2 days. Maybe if he could get to the couch, they wouldn't notice the staring emptiness of Petit Mal. Hardly able to navigate through the sea of stars that now surrounded him, he somehow found the couch, nearly sitting on Maggie's lap.
"Slow down, Buster," Caitlin snapped.
"Sorry, sorry." He slumped back. Before him was not the gleaming sliver he usually saw, but a room. There was a person there, a child. She was exquisitely beautiful,
and recognizable. He cried out, and the seizure was over.
Dan!
Sorry.
Dan, aren't you hearing me? Stop the boys!
Then he realized that Pauly and Connor were outside and running like two mad things toward the field, flashlights bobbing. The world seemed to stop. Harley and Maggie looked up at him, their expressions identical, eyebrows raised, slight smiles playing on their faces.
Chris said, "This could be it."
Caitlin burst out the door and went running down the stairs. Dan followed.
"Come on, Connor," Pauly yelled.
"Calm down,"
Connor yelled back.
"Stay together."
Dan was aware that the Warners had come out onto the deck and were quietly standing and watching. Then he saw Chris beside them.
"You better come down here," he shouted.
It all seemed to be happening in slow motion as Chris came across the deck and down the stairs. Dan ran after Connor and Caitlin, moving more slowly through the woods because he had only the light of the object to guide him. When he broke out into the field, he saw an extremely bright light, but it appeared to be more of a pinpoint. He could see the silhouettes of the two boys close to it, and Caitlin coming up behind them.
"We mean you no harm," Connor yelled. Then,
"Nous vous voulons dire aucun mal."
"Connor, get back,"
Caitlin shouted.
"Come to meet us," Pauly cried.
His voice almost bubbled. Dan ran harder. The children should be very damn afraid.
"Wait, I'm getting a mental communication," Connor said. "They want us to come closer."
"Hold hands, buddy."
The two boys went forward, and suddenly the light went out.
"Run, boys,"
Dan shouted. Then he heard laughter, a lot of young laughter. There was more laughter behind him, and he turned to see the Warners breaking out of the woods. They were laughing, too.
"Oh, shit," Chris said from the dark. "I never win."
There were flashlights up ahead, and as Dan arrived, he realized that he was surrounded by kids, and they were laughing and jeering and shining flashlights on Connor, who was trapped in the center of a circle of derision. It had been a prank, and it looked as if most of Connor's classmates were here. Connor put his hands over his head as if he was being stoned by the voices. Caitlin ran around the outside of the circle, trying to part it to get to her boy. Harley and Maggie Warner came up chuckling amiably.
"That's our gasoline lantern," Harley said. "It came back from Neptune just in time."
Dan closed his fist, pulled back, and just barely managed to stop himself from decking Harley.
"Hey," Harley said, "it's a joke. An innocent, practical joke. They've been planning it all day. We need something to cut the tension, man."
"At my son's expense."
He was not as careful as Caitlin, who was still trying to gently push kids aside. He grabbed a fistful of somebody's jacket and hurled what turned out to be a girl to the ground. As she screamed and cursed at him, he waded in and reached his son.
"Get out of here," Connor shrilled.
"Please, just get out of here."
"Connor, come home," Caitlin said, joining them. She looked around them. "You're pitiful. All of you."
"Asshole," came a muffled yell from the dark. "Bitch."
Their arms around their boy, Caitlin and Dan headed for home. As they passed the Warners, Dan said, "You stay away from our place and keep that fat troll of yours away from our son."
"Dan,"
Harley called after him.
"Hey, man, stay loose."
When they returned to the house, Chris was already back. He and Nancy were replaying the video. "It's real, you know," Chris said. Connor started to run downstairs.
"Hey, wait," Chris caught up to him.
"Hold on. We have historic footage here. Come on back, take another look."
"Dr. Jeffers, I really can't right now."
"Forget those kids, Connor. The Warners are idiots, and the Keltons haven't got the faintest idea what this actually is.
This video is one of the most precious records ever created by the human hand.